Whether spread out across a sports field, gathered together around the dining table, or alone with some electronic device, we've probably all played one of those games where the winner is the one who really does take all. Be it points or pieces or pounds, whatever you gain is your opponent's loss by an equivalent amount. The winner is the one who goes on taking until their opposition has been stripped of their very last piece, until they have been reduced to nothing. These are known as zero-sum games, and they can be a lot of fun in the context of play. What is less fun is when we try to play zero-sum games in the context of the rest of life. Here in Daniel chapter 5, we're introduced to Belshazzar, the prince regent of Babylon. This is how Belshazzar sees himself in relation to the Most High God, locked into some kind of zero-sum game. For Belshazzar to be all in all, the God of Israel must be reduced to nothing. The setting is this great banquet. Gathered together were 1,000 of Babylon's nobles, that is, the elite through whom the king exercised his authority and rule across that vast empire. That night, Belshazzar has an idea. It's not a new idea. It's been carefully orchestrated. With all the key players here assembled and primed, as that plentiful supply of wine continued to flow and everyone's inhibitions were lifted by it, Belshazzar orders that the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem be brought in. Verse 2. These goblets that belong to the Most High God. In the game that he is playing, Belshazzar now thinks they belong to him. These goblets, when at home in the temple of Jerusalem, wine would be drunk from them, speaking of the most intimate fellowship with the God of Israel. Now Belshazzar has them filled with his own wine. And then he has his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drink from them in his name and in the name of the gods of Babylon. The picture is clear. In taking these pieces of silver and gold, which were solely for God's use, and now putting them to his own use, the Most High God is reduced to nothing in Belshazzar's estimations. But that's not all. This foolish king has gone further. In making his ruling elite drink from these same goblets, he is making them complicit in his willful rejection of the Most High God. Indeed, that night at that banquet, Belshazzar couldn't have made a more powerful statement of how he intended Babylon to be. This is his new and progressive vision for the empire, a truly idolatrous regime. The greater a responsibility a person holds, the greater the need for them to act responsibly, because the consequences of their actions are so far-reaching. That's why we must pray for our leaders. What of Belshazzar himself? Is he simply some new and enlightened man? Not at all. No one ever is. There have been a few other kings on the throne of Babylon since the great king Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, Belshazzar is not himself the reigning king. He was only keeping the seat warm for his absent father, Nabonidus. And not so many years have passed since Nebuchadnezzar was sitting where Belshazzar is now sitting. It's even possible that Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's maternal grandfather. Imagine what bedtime stories might have been like. with all the donkey impressions and wild animal noises thrown in. But whether Belshazzar knew Nebuchadnezzar personally or only by the long shadow he continued to cast in the life of the royal court, we can't know for sure. But everything that Belshazzar enacts at this banquet is a carefully calculated rejection of Nebuchadnezzar's legacy. Last week, we were hearing about the remarkable story of Nebuchadnezzar's humbling at the hands of the God of Israel. He quite literally came through it, a new man. There towards the end of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar tells us what he had come to realize. Verse 34. I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" What was the radical thing that Nebuchadnezzar came to realize? That which he would never have acknowledged before? This, that he was as nothing in relation to God. That truth will be to a person, any person, either the most offensive thing or the most freeing thing they ever hear. One of the two. We've seen how Nebuchadnezzar heard it. How did Belshazzar hear it? To belittle yourself in that way was not befitting a king of Babylon. That's how Belshazzar heard it. Belshazzar knew only too well what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar. How the Most High had made someone far greater out of the man who knew he was as nothing. But that would never be how he would be treated. That was never how he was to come before the Lord. Belshazzar would never admit that he was as nothing. So in his obstinacy, he locks himself into this zero-sum game. Surely he didn't think it was one he could ever win. But that's the problem with pride. It blinds us. The last words of Nebuchadnezzar, recorded for us here, are there at the end of chapter 4, immediately before we're introduced to Belshazzar. So they clearly have Belshazzar in view. Verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. What is pride? Ultimately, pride is accounting God as nothing and accounting yourself as everything. Belshazzar's condition is so easy to diagnose. So it can only be a matter of time before that hand which no one can hold back appears. Earlier this week, I met a Korean missionary, and we were discussing the recent history of North Korea. In the last 60 years, there have been only three rulers of that nation, comprising the Kim dynasty. The first of these, Kim Il-sung, was born to Christian parents. He even attended a school founded by Christian missionaries. Evidently, there was something about his parents' faith and his parents' God which jarred with him. So, the moment Kim Il-sung took power, he chose to make himself everything and this God nothing in North Korea. and he very quickly set about persecuting Christians. As so often is the case, it was personal. Perhaps Kim Il-sung had taken a leaf out of Belshazzar's book. Pity he didn't read it through to the end. Several things are quite comical in what happens next for Belshazzar. Here's the man who would have himself and everyone else believe that he is sovereign. But when the fingers of that hand appear and begin writing on the wall, there he is, verse 6, pale in the face, his knees knocking together. The enchanters and astrologers and diviners are quickly summoned with equally comical words. There will be purple and gold. But the position that goes with that is only third highest ruler in the kingdom. This man, who has acted as though God is under him, here admits that Daddy is still above him. With Nabonidus on the throne, Belshazzar can appoint someone as third highest ruler, which isn't bad. But that position is only as secure as Belshazzar himself. Now enter Daniel. We get to see so often in this book that Daniel is brought in at just the right time. He is God's appointed man for the moment. And as we've got to know this man over these past weeks, there is one thing that we've seen again and again. Daniel is the man who refused to become Belteshazzar. That name is repeated there in verse 12. Daniel the Israelite is the man who refused to become Belteshazzar the Babylonian. We've seen him repeatedly refusing to eat at the table and drink from the goblets belonging to the Babylonian kings. To do so would have meant becoming complicit in all that Babylon stood for, to assimilate its idolatrous beliefs. But Daniel was content with the fellowship he found elsewhere, with the Most High God. Belteshazzar sounds remarkably like Belshazzar, and we're meant to draw the comparison. Belshazzar is who Daniel could have become, but he didn't. Daniel doesn't find himself locked into a zero-sum game with the God of Israel. That's because he knows that God isn't locked into a zero-sum game with us. It's not the way he works. For Daniel, the one who holds all authority and glory and sovereign power is one like a son of man, one whose purpose is to humble the proud, not to destroy them. Indeed, this son of man chooses to be there with his people in the fiery furnaces of their suffering to see that they are never reduced to nothing. So Daniel need make no pretense about being a something. He can walk in the freedom of knowing that before God he is as nothing. And because he does, God exalts him again and again. The promise that Daniel holds on to is the one presented to us in the last chapter of this book, chapter 12, verse 2. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. A resurrection from the dead by which we will outshine the stars of the heavens. That's the promise. When Belshazzar now offers purple robes, a gold chain, and third highest ruler, that all sounds rather bargain basement by comparison. And that very night, Babylon is about to be brought down into the dust of the earth never to rise and shine again. With all this in his armory, it's no surprise that Daniel answers the king the way he does. Verse 17. You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Daniel is there in God's employ, not Belshazzar's. He goes on. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. And in what follows, Daniel diagnoses exactly how it is with Belshazzar. This is not simply Nebuchadnezzar on replay. Verse 22. You, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this about your grandfather. Although at that banquet he pretended otherwise, Belshazzar knew that the Most High is not blind or deaf or lacking in understanding. From all that had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, he knew that the God of Israel was not another of those inanimate idols of his own making. Yet still he rejected him. People often like to think that they have rejected God on the basis of their intellect. There can't be a God. But most often, that rejection is brought about on the basis of their will. There won't be a God. So Belshazzar's prideful, willful rejection left him without excuse. See now the words which had appeared on that wall. Mene, mene, tekel, parzin. This wasn't in some strange, unrecognizable script. This was plain, straightforward language of the kind you would use every day in financial exchanges in the marketplace. So Belshazzar would have had no difficulty reading it. And on any other day, in any other context, he may well have understood it. Yet he can make no sense of it at all as it now appears on the banqueting hall wall. He can make no sense of it. But Daniel can. Or rather, Daniel can by the Holy Spirit's enabling. See verse 26. Mene. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. At the end of a lavish banquet, what does it cost you? All those bottles of wine, all those joints of meat, all that fresh fruit added to the tally. What does the final figure come out as? There's a few extra zeros there you weren't planning on. That's mene. Tekel. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. The waiter is at your table with the card machine, but no matter how many times you stab in the PIN number, your card keeps getting rejected. You don't have nearly enough funds to cover the outlay on this idolatrous feast. That's tekel. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. The debt arising from this banquet must be paid. If there's a cash flow problem, that can be got round by liquidating Belshazzar's other assets, many of which were conveniently already assembled, soon to be divided up by a foreign army. That's parzin. It didn't have to come to this for Belshazzar. It could have been, as it was for Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar, remember, he humbly acknowledged that he was nothing. And so God was able to make something great of him. The last thing that King Belshazzar would ever admit was that he was nothing. And so sadly, all that awaits him is being brought to nothing. Right in the middle of this storm stands Daniel. What are we to make of him? As we read these accounts of his faithfulness to God and God's faithfulness to him, right there in such a hostile environment, perhaps we're somewhat in awe of the man that he was and the witness that he gave. We may be very aware that we are not Daniel. But that's okay. You see, neither is Daniel any of us. Might it be that Daniel himself would look to us in our day and be in awe of the opportunities for witness that present themselves to you and I? After all, the kingdom of the living God that will not be destroyed, the dominion that will never end, that was nearly all future in Daniel's day. In our day, it is on the advance across the world in ways that Daniel could only have dreamed. Many other Babylons have fallen along the way. Others still will. Yes, but Daniel, he was given visions and could interpret signs and dreams. Well, let's not forget that we too have the same spirit. As the Apostle Paul writes, we have received the Spirit who is from God, that we may understand what God has freely given us. We stand from the vantage point of prophecy fulfilled. In Scripture, we have been given understanding so that we can witness to the certainty of God's coming kingdom, making sense of the rising and falling of the kingdoms of this world. Daniel has us at no disadvantage. You and I have the mind of Christ. Let's remember that. The fingers of the hand that wrote on the wall of Belshazzar's banqueting hall, the next time we see them writing, it is on the ground, in the dust, before a woman caught in adultery. A group of teachers of the law and Pharisees brought this woman before the Son of Man. Their minds were made up. This woman should be reduced to nothing. She should be stoned there and then. But the Apostle John tells us, Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground. The words that Jesus wrote were clearly for the benefit of those in the crowd, not for the accused woman. What were they? We're not told. Could they have been mene, mene, tekel, parzin? Who knows? But this Jesus is the one who writes with authority the verdict over each of our lives. Between writing, this is what Jesus said to those gathered there. If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at this woman. One by one, the accusers backed away. They had been weighed in the scales and found wanting. But so had the woman. What's the difference between them? It's that the woman stands humbly before Jesus. She makes no pretense about being anything other than she is. She is as nothing before him. Jesus is all about humbling the proud and exalting the humble. Some will let him do that. Others will walk away. The good news is that Jesus is the God who made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being found in human likeness. Jesus is the God who humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Why? Jesus became nothing so that nothings can become something. All so that Daniel, that Nebuchadnezzar, that this adulterous woman, that you and I need not end up as dust, but have a shining resurrection hope. So let's give up those zero-sum games we may be tempted to play with God. As Belshazzar discovered too late, it is useless to set ourselves up against the Lord of heaven. The writing is already on the wall. A writing that, if it stands alone, brings our lives to nothing. But the fingers of the hand that wrote those words belong to the one who was also nailed to the cross, who became nothing in our place. Imagine what it would be like to be weighed on the scales and not found wanting. There is a way, only one way, to be found humbled at the foot of the cross, drinking from the very different cup of wine that Jesus offers to us. The most bizarre part of this whole episode, after Belshazzar's heard the verdict written against him, well, it's the way in which he carries on as usual. Maybe it's denial. Maybe it's Belshazzar's attempt to save face. Verse 29. Those purple clothes and that gold chain that Daniel didn't want, they're still placed on him. And he is proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. But what does that mean? For how long? You see, things are not going to carry on as normal. It's God's will be done, not Belshazzar's. The enemy army is already camped at the city gates that very night this king is slain. Belshazzar, and with him the whole Babylonian Empire, goes down into the dust of the earth, never to rise again. So, friends, today is the day to choose to do what Belshazzar would never bring himself to do. Humbly on our knees before the Son of Man. Today really is the day, because today is the only day we really have. Amen.